I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Welcome back to Radio Times. Camden has been struggling for years with all the problems associated with poverty. There's been a significant investment in the city and some signs that life is improving for the 70,000 people who live there, but it still has a long way to go. Later this hour, Radio Times producer Elizabeth Fiedler will take us on a tour of Camden, a city she loves, and we'll meet some of the police officers determined to improve their relationship with the residents and reduce crime. But first, to set the stage, we ask Greg Adamidis to join us, and he is supervising reporter at New Jersey Advance Media. He's been covering Camden City for the South Jersey Times and for NJ.com. And Greg, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Nice to be here.
And to our listeners, lines open at 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Last week, Camden Mayor Dana Redd delivered a rather upbeat assessment of Camden. What are some of the bright spots in that city?
Well, on Saturday morning, I took a bike ride around the waterfront, I guess just to get a better idea of what your nice fall weekend morning is like. And the aquarium was packed. The parking lot was packed. There were families coming and going the entire time. But that was it. There's still an empty baseball stadium. There's still a half dozen parking lots that were completely empty, save the one for the aquarium. Wiggins Park, which is right next door, was still completely empty. The battleship... Sure, it's an attraction, mm-hmm. but how many times are you going to go there? There might have been a half dozen people there. It has its draws. It's coming along, but it's not enough at the point. At right now, it's not enough to draw in what the city needs to grow, to give more people jobs. Now, yeah, there's a...
Are there jobs, though, associated with the waterfront?
That's kind of the catch that a lot of residents complain about is you've got Subaru coming from Cherry Hill, but they're already bringing most of the jobs with it. The Holtec's coming, Campbell's is still there, but all these companies that are coming to Camden and getting these massive tax breaks that are signed off on by the state, a lot of these jobs already exist. And when I meet with residents who are upset about their way of life, they constantly bring that up. What are you doing for us? It's been like this for 40 years.
The mayor, Dana Redd, those felt that there were some signs of improvement.
The Eds and Meds section, I don't have it in front of me, but she said between 30% and 40% of jobs in the city are in education, in the medical field. That's good. What other economy there is there? That's what remains to be seen at this point.
There was a, I would say, significant at least interest slash investment in Camden coming from the Christie administration. And one of the problems there, of course, was the school system. Have there been improvements in education in Camden?
Yeah, the school district remains under the state's thumb. There is an advisory board that helps guide it. Christie appointed the superintendent, and I spoke with the school district spokesman a couple days ago about Christie's fairness formula,
right,
which is going to give each student in each school district $6,599. Now, the school district spokesman told me that Camden's getting closer to $25,000 per pupil, and he remained skeptic at this point because it is a while down the road, but he told me that it's something that they're keeping an eye on, and it's a wait-and-see approach because I guess you need that money.
Well, sure.
That is an ice bath, I'd assume.
What about graduation rates and test scores? Have there been improvements since there has been a new superintendent?
Graduation rates as of January of this year are up to 64%, which is up from 49% in 2012. State took over in the end of the school year, I believe, in 2013. So, yes, there are improvements there. There are charter schools coming in. There are Renaissance schools, which partner with the school district. That is also a point of contention because a lot of residents say, the public schools are falling apart. There's disinvestment there, yet the state's signing off on these nonprofits to come in and operate these charter schools in they're mandated that they have to be in new buildings. They're nicer. The teachers don't have unions. So you can kind of bring
it. They're charter schools.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
They have their own rules and regulations.
Right. I mean, you still have to, when the state tests, when they say how high you have to jump to reach that, you're not, you can operate independently of a school district, but it's still the same expectations you have to reach in educating these kids.
There's going to be a new Camden High School, right, under construction?
Yeah, that is to the tune of $133 million. That's coming from the School Development Authority. That's state money. That's long in the making, but finalized. A lot of community meetings leading up to that at a recent Board of Education meeting. That was a big deal. I spoke with residents out front who they're skeptical of it because they don't like charter schools. Where am I going to send my kid while this school's being—
In the interim, right?
Yeah, the district said they're working that out. I called the School Development Authority. They didn't want to— they wouldn't say one way or the other what the plan is. That's supposed to be finalized and announced in January.
What about quality of life? And that's, that's a big category. But in terms of, and you touched on this earlier, but for people that live in Camden, there are about 70,000 people that call Camden their home. Has their life improved in any way in the last couple of years? Are there ways to say this is up, this is down?
When I talk to people living there, unfortunately, most of the time, it's at the scene of a murder. I go there and I what's the neighborhood like? How are things? Bad.
That's what they say. That's what they tell you.
Yeah, it's bad, and it's been like this for so long. It's just kind of this is the way it is. When 8-year-old Gabby Carter was shot and killed, I was out there talking to residents and I've been doing this for 6 years, and it was the most uncomfortable scene to be at. Why? I don't know. I'm not in that neighborhood's head, but I could tell that it was a place that I wasn't supposed to be. And I understand that when people criticize me for covering the city, yeah, I am an outsider. You're right, but it's a place that I've always tried to cover each angle of fairly and as well as I can.
The crime rate is up. I think homicides are up something like 28% in the first 9 months of 2016. And there was an effort, obviously, with this reconstituted police department to try to address not just the crime rate, but also relationship with the neighborhood.
Well, an hour ago this morning, actually, 58 new officers were sworn in. That brings the ranks up to 410, which is an absolute milestone for the department. They've always wanted a little more than 400, and I'm fairly certain this is the first time they've topped 400 since the force was formed. As of this week, we're at 38 homicides in Camden City, which is up from 32 the year before, 33 in 2014. Those two numbers, though, are significantly lower than 2013, which is 59, which is the year— well, I mean, the police force was formed in May 2013, so I guess you sort of had half a year of Camden City's police force that was disbanded, rehired. It was, from what I'm told, it was a strong union, and it cost a lot of money to run, and there was absenteeism, and I mean that's why this decision was made. The Chief Thompson's approach to policing is, I believe it's guardians, not warriors.
Yes.
Yes.
We'll be hearing from him later in the hour.
I've met with him a bunch. And I can see what the vision is, and you can just as easily see officers walking the beat. And I've also had ex-officers reach out to me who have said, it is tough, every day is a struggle, and when cops are coming, getting trained, starting a metro, and then bailing back to another their hometown police department.
Because it's outside the city?
Well, yeah, because Camden County's police force, they have exhausted Camden County applicants. So you have to look all over the place. So you've got a guy coming from Bergen County or from the shore to go police Camden City. And that'll burn you out before you even get there. And then you got to go work a shift. And, yeah, it's Camden. I hate that that's the reputation that the place holds. but it's been written off by so many people so long ago.
Is there any way that you've been able to judge if there's been a changed relationship with the police department and the community it serves?
Yeah, I attended a meeting ahead of the police department rolling out body cameras, and it was I think there were two or three of them, and it was pretty well attended. And when it came time for Q&A, it wasn't really about the body cameras. It was people in the audience telling the chief that, yeah, we like what your guys are doing. We see them more often. Yeah, there's movie nights, and there's ice cream, and there's fireworks, and there's all sorts of stuff that the police department is doing for the community. That did the city department do it? I don't know. I wasn't here. I kind of think that's the perspective that I bring to covering Camden, is that when I came in, it was all a done deal. The metro was already formed.
And that's the police department.
Yeah, Camden Metro was already formed. The school district was already under the state's thumb. The big business is coming to Camden. That had already been announced. So a lot of what I cover, it's reactionary. There's no more rallies. There's no more fights. This is all happening. And the mayor's vision that she talked about at the breakfast last week, it's all in progress.
Is there a police oversight board? Is that a bone of contention?
The police oversight board was a recommendation made by the president in his 21st Century Policing Initiative. There was a meeting in April that residents were also welcome out to. They were able to submit questions. The answers from the police department just came back, and the department said it had no interest in creating such an oversight board. There's already state oversight on anything of question when it comes to the police department.
Is that something, though, that residents wanted, or a certain subset of the residents wanted?
That's something that I gather. There's the local NAACP chapter is critical of the police department insofar as it's no longer racially representative of the city, and it's a, their quotes, revolving door of people who come in, can't hack it, go away. And they say that that's not effective. Crime's down. Yeah, okay, sure, the homicide rate's up, but you can't control that. Every time I go out to a scene of a shooting, there's no common thread besides gun violence. There's really, you can't be everywhere. You can turn on the shot spotter, which detects gunshots and send officers after the fact, but yeah, it's a force of 400, but it's a big city with big city problems, and you can't walk that beat all the time.
Well, Greg Adamidis, thanks for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thank you.
We're going to take a short break, and then Radio Times producer Elizabeth Fiedler will take us to Camden to meet some of the dedicated police officers who are defusing a situation last November that could have gotten out of control. We'll be right back. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY. As we heard, crime in Camden, New Jersey has soared this year, but that's not the whole story in this long, struggling city. The police department has been through some big changes in the past few years, including concerted efforts to change the department's culture. Radio Times producer Elizabeth Fiedler will be bringing us stories from Camden in the coming months, giving us a portrait of the people who live there. Send us your thoughts via email and Twitter while we listen to Elizabeth's first piece. It's about crime, policing, an incident last November, and culture change.
Get ready to hear the story of a city many left for dead, a tiny speck on a map across the bridge from Philadelphia. Camden is a place I know and love, and one that most people I know will never voluntarily step foot in. In Camden, I'll introduce you to fascinating people. We'll explore answers to some of the huge questions America is facing about life, race, and policing in our cities. Come with me into shops, homes, and cop cars across this city, and I promise you'll be surprised by what we hear. For this first episode, we'll start with those who are sworn to protect this very dangerous city, the cops. We'll get a first-person account of danger outside a fried chicken restaurant. We'll visit Aunt Kat's house, and we'll find out what motivates a guy who's not even from Camden to become a cop here. So, let's go.
My name is Officer Davis, and Officer Cabrera Davis, and what we're looking at is the Crown Fried Chicken. The location for the incident involving the male that was being very aggressive and threatening with a knife.
On that November night, there stood 48-year-old Brian Garrett just outside the Crown Fried Chicken at the busy corner of Broadway and Mickle, waving a knife. Cabrera, the police officer, is a friendly woman who grew up in Camden. She knows its dangers, and she was one of several officers to show up on the scene in the heart of the city. Here she is, trying to assess the danger.
What could happen? What's he going to do? Where's he going to go? If he attempts to attack somebody, what am I going to do? What's the consequences of that?
Cabrera knew the man wasn't in his right mind. She'd seen him earlier in the night behaving erratically, walking up and down the sidewalk, yelling and asking people for money, grunting at them. He just threatened to kill someone inside the Crown Fried. Perhaps this setup sounds a little familiar, reminiscent of the Chicago police's fatal encounter in 2014 with a knife-wielding teenager named Laquan McDonald.
6 seconds after arriving on scene, the police officer who was charged with first-degree murder is seen with his weapon pointing at Laquan McDonald, and he starts shooting.
That incident ended up costing the Chicago police superintendent his job and Laquan McDonald his life. But you've never heard about this incident in Camden because of how Cabrera and the other cops handled it. The Crown Fried Chicken restaurant has a huge red sign. It sits at a major intersection in a pretty busy commercial corridor. Both sides of the street are lined with businesses. There's a nail salon, a sneaker store. It's a Wednesday night, and there are usually about a dozen people at least around. But right now, the street is empty, except for Brian Garrett, who's gripping the knife, and he's surrounded by cops. Police have preemptively cleared the blocks in front of him so they can deal with the situation.
We at 53 and 52, Broadway and Mickle, Crown Fried.
The male's swinging the knife actively, and when I got out of my patrol vehicle, he looked at me and I could see his face, and his eyes were like bugged out of his head, and I could see he wasn't, you know, mentally stable.
That's Chris Devlin. He's not tall, but in his uniform, he still makes an intimidating impression. This part of downtown is his beat. He knows all the regulars. This had been a quiet shift until Brian Garrett showed up with a knife.
We could have used deadly force. You know, that's always the last resort for us, and you know, it's not something that we like to jump to right away. But, you know, one of my concerns, and I know some of the other officers, was there's people in these stores. If he turns and goes into these stores with these people in there with a knife, now we have a hostage situation.
Chris often patrols on foot. Since Camden's old force disbanded in 2012 and was replaced by this new county force, everybody just calls it Metro, longtime residents can't get over how often they see Metro out of their cars, walking, talking to neighbors, no warrants to serve, just chatting. This is astonishing. In a city where a few years ago police stopped showing up at traffic accidents without injuries, there just weren't enough cops. Then, in May 2013, the city dissolved its police force and started a new one.
Okay, let's pause for a second and take a step back in time to check out that new Camden Police Department.
The county force had a special little part called Metro that would patrol just Camden City. The berth from city force to county wasn't pain-free. About 100 cops who were hired for the new force have left. Some say the long hours and exhausting foot patrols in this dangerous city just weren't for them. Camden County is trying to get back the money it spent to train those police who left.
There's more to this story. The Camden County Department has its critics. We'll get to them in a future episode.
And then there are the cops who've stayed, like Cabrera and Chris. In many ways, they represent the pulse of the new Camden force. Cabrera's been breathing Camden air her whole life. She knew what she was getting into. She doesn't remember ever seeing a cop outside a police car when she was a kid here. Her father was shot to death when she was 9.
It was a hard time because I was young and I didn't have a relationship with him. And so when I lost him, you know, that basically destroyed any chance that I would have of having a relationship with him. I understand what it's like to lose somebody.
We're out here making a difference in, you know, a community that some people thought was never salvageable. So I feel that's a good accomplishment above anything else, you know, making people feel safe in their own community.
Chris grew up near Asbury Park, about an hour and a half away, toward the ocean. He comes from a blue family, but he hadn't planned on being a cop, at least not in Camden. In fact, he'd only been here once, for Dave Matthews' concert.
From what I've heard about Camden, it was a crime-ridden city. You know, there was a lot of guns, a lot of drugs, and, you know, it was dangerous.
He was right. And then the county force took over. And believe me, much to the surprise of just about everyone, things started to get better. In May of that year, 2015, the chief got a personal shout-out from Barack Obama when the president came to Camden to tout the early success of the Metro Force.
I've come here to Camden to do something that might have been unthinkable just a few years ago. And that's to hold you up as a symbol of promise for the nation.
Murders cut in half over 2 years. Violent crime down a quarter. Those were impressive numbers, and in Camden, it felt remarkable. But to Police Chief Scott Thompson, statistics aren't even the most important signs of progress.
What I tell my officers is, I don't measure those traditional statistics. I don't care how many tickets you're writing when you're out there. What I want to see in your area of responsibility when I drive down the street is I want to see little kids playing in front of their house. I want to see people sitting on their front steps. I don't want the local business owner or pastor calling me if there's a problem, because they should know you. They should have your cell phone number as well.
In Thompson's office, a painting of George Washington kneeling in prayer at Valley Forge holds a place of honor on the wall. It's a daily reminder for him that you can still triumph, even when the battle looks unwinnable.
Why are you still in Camden?
I've got miles to go and promises to keep before I sleep. There's people I love that are here. You know, this is where my roots are. My grandmother worked at the RCA factory. My grandfather was a hatchman on submarines at the New York shipyard right down on South Broadway. I love this city.
Thompson's ways to throw everything at the problem: shoe leather, technology, training, and culture change.
And the nightly protests in Ferguson, Missouri over a deadly police shooting are not letting up. Street violence raged for hours last night. At least two people in a crowd of protesters were shot, two businesses burned, and four officers were injured by rocks or bottles, and police arrested 31 people.
And all of this started just hours after National Guard troops arrived in Ferguson.
Those famous images from Ferguson, Missouri of police armed to the teeth battling citizens in the streets, and clashes in other cities, they bothered him.
I think it gave every progressive law enforcement leader in this country a moment of pause, and some of the progress we think that we have made, particularly in our most challenged communities and our communities of color over the last three decades, gave us a moment of pause in which maybe we haven't made as much progress as we think we have made. And we needed to get back to the basics. We needed to get back to the fundamentals.
When Thompson says get back to the fundamentals, he means it. Instead of cracking down hard and trying to arrest his way out of the city's massive crime problem, the chiefs implemented a program called Ethical Protector. The name, I think, says it all.
The bedrock principles are the sanctity of human life. Our objective is just not to ensure that the officer goes home at the end of their shift, but that everybody goes home and is able to be returned to their loved one. Our officers know that they are not judge, jury, or executioner. They are there to stabilize situations and to help people. We are guardians. We are not warriors.
It gears our officers to value life. It deals in morals and ethics.
Come with me for just a minute to hear from a veteran cop named Sergeant Raphael Thornton. He's done just about every policing job possible in his decades on the force here, and he believes the Ethical Protector training is a game changer for newbies and for veteran officers like him.
It deals in the fact that all life is important, even the bad guys. It reduces that gray area where an officer might mess up, make a mistake.
Sergeant Thornton sets a guarded tone at the beginning of our interview, but as we talked, he got more comfortable. He pointed out a local sandwich shop called Donkey's, and he even took me to the street he grew up on.
Nice two-story houses, nice lawns.
We used to always get in trouble for playing street football and hitting our neighbor's cars and running into them.
At one of the houses, he asks if I mind if he stops for a few minutes to see his aunt, Kat. We pull up in the cop car, and he strides out toward an older woman who looks ecstatic to see him. The joy is visible on her face, and it's a beautiful moment to witness.
Aunt Kat!
Hey, baby! Hey, I was just telling everybody I saw you! Hi, honey! Come on in! How are you?
Hi, Elizabeth. I'm a reporter.
Pleased to meet you!
You too!
You too! I was just telling everybody! I saw Ray on TV! My handsome baby! This is my baby!
I was just showing her the block I grew up on.
How long have you lived in this house?
about 60 years?
Yeah. Well, way before. I'm there since I remember.
And your name is Aunt Kat?
Yeah, I'm Aunt Kat.
Thank you. A pleasure.
You're so welcome.
Nice to meet you as well.
Back outside in the police car, with a heavy rain pouring down, Sergeant Thornton is hopeful that life in Camden can get better. But he knows the challenges facing the cops on the street. This place, he says, it wears you down.
I believe as officers working in the inner city or working in a high crime area, you start to develop that mindset of us against them. And we start to lose sight of what we're really there for, and that's to protect everybody. We make sure the criminals are safe. I mean, yes, they're going to jail, but we want to use the minimum amount of force to make that happen. And we do that by, one, our mindset, and two, our tactics. And the Ethical Protector Program, it keys on both of those aspects of policing.
Sergeant Thornton was the first person to tell me about the man with the knife incident. A 1096, a person out of control.
Me a 53 and a 52 rolling nickel Crown Fried. Name it after the same.
Back outside the Crown Fried Chicken, Officer Cabrilla Davis was about to put that ethical protector training that the police chief and Sergeant Thornton talked up. She's about to put it to use when it matters the most, the moment of crisis.
Instead of us getting aggressive and advancing towards him, we attempted to verbally engage him. That training, I guess, it gives you a level of confidence because it's like, okay, it forces you to take a step back mentally and look at the situation and figure out what the best possible approach is and what's the safest approach.
Drop the knife. Sir, drop the knife.
That's Officer Chris Devlin.
Sir, drop the knife.
He's right behind the man with the knife.
Sir, I'm telling you, drop the knife or I'm going to tase you.
You can feel the tension in the air watching the video. But unlike officers in other cities whose crisis moment choices have resulted in headlines, protest marches, firings, indictments, and death, the Camden officers do not pull their guns.
Drop the knife.
This is from camera footage provided by the police, made up of video from the taser, Eye in the Sky, and closed-circuit cameras. The weird thing about watching this video is how slowly, almost leisurely, the scene plays out.
And this whole time, we're just talking to him, you know, trying to get him to drop the knife, trying to put people out of harm's way.
Yeah, in the video, your voice is very strong, straightforward. Did you not feel nervous in that moment or something?
I mean, of course I don't want to say nervous, but it's nerve-wracking because you don't know what's going to happen in any situation like that, especially with somebody that doesn't appear to be mentally stable, because they can turn any second and things can happen.
About 2 minutes into the tape, you can see the man with a knife walking slowly, surrounded by a knot of officers. They're keeping pace beside and behind him. The little group walks down this nice-looking street. Wide sidewalks, street trees with little fences around the base. About two blocks in, Chris Devlin fires his taser. But it doesn't penetrate the man's thick jacket. I didn't realize before Chris told me that
After firing a taser, you're physically connected to whoever you fired your taser at. So Chris, the cop, is just a few feet away from the man with the knife, and he's physically connected to him, forced to weave back and forth, dodging cars and trees, following him. Watching the video, the incident seems like it'll never end. They all just keep walking.
It can feel like the time is just endless.
Them kind of incidents just always feel longer than they are. You know, it feels like you're stuck in time almost, and you just want it to come to an end.
We're nearly 6 minutes into the video now. Things are about to turn chaotic. The camera image gets shaky. They're blurry glimpses of moving bodies. It's very hard to tell what's going on. And then,
all of a sudden, I don't know what came over him, but he dropped the knife. We heard it hit the ground, and we immediately took him to the ground and put him in handcuffs.
Chris Devlin pounces on him. Cabrera's there, too. On the video, you see the man on the ground, the taser strings still attached to him, glimmering like tiny bolts of lightning.
It could have ended very differently, and it could have ended badly, but, you know, everyone kept their calm and kept poise, and it ended with a good outcome.
The video will spawn no angry marches or grand juries. Instead, it offers evidence of how one of the most dangerous cities in America may be changing.
And that's Radio Times producer Elizabeth Fiedler. She'll be bringing us more stories from Camden. Coming up next, The Cure and the music of the 80s and 90s. Stay with us. We'll be right back. I'm Marty Moscowen, and we close out the hour by listening to Radio Times producer John Aaron's interview with Lal Tolhurst. He was the co-founder of the band The Cure that had hit songs in the 80s and 90s. Tolhurst's new memoir is called Cured, The Tale of Two Imaginary Boys, which recounts his childhood friendship with the band's frontman, Robert Smith, the start of the band, and their rise to international success. Email us and tweet us with your comments and listen.
So I'll begin with your childhood, in which you met co-founder of The Cure, Robert Smith. The two of you were kids, and you were growing up in a London suburb called Crawley. You got into the punk movement. I'm wondering, what did punk mean to you back then? And what did just punk in general mean back then?
Well, I think, you know, you have to look at the times. And when we were growing up in the mid-70s, The predominant music scene where we were was really either disco or really overblown sort of prog rock, and neither genre sort of resonated with, you know, the three young guys from suburbs. So I think what happened was, you know, the punk thing gave us the permission to be what we wanted to be.
And how did the citizens of Crawley take to your guys' punk attitude?
Well, mostly the same thing that they normally did, which was to, you know, ignore us most of the time. If they didn't ignore us, then they would get in fights with us. But it wasn't really important, because the important thing was we knew once we'd started on that road that we were going to get out of there.
And eventually you went to form the band Easy Cure. Can you tell me about, you know, getting started playing music and how the band came together?
You know, we both at school together. So when you go from those teenage years into adulthood, you know, you go through a very special time with people, and the people that you went through that time with, they know things about you that nobody else ever will know about you, and you share a special bond. So that's when we really discovered music. You know, and I can remember Robert coming up to me in the school library and asking me, hey, you know Jimi Hendrix? And I go, yeah, I know Hendrix. And we started to talk about that, and we realized we both loved music, you know.
I do want to play a clip from your band Easy Cure. This is before you called yourselves just The Cure. It's a demo called I Just Need Myself.
I'm
heard that for a very, very long time. What's striking to me is we can actually play.
Yeah.
You know, which we were only like 15, 16, something like that. But yeah, no, we can play. So, you know, that was quite a revelation to me to hear that.
You guys changed your name to The Cure and had a bit of a lineup rearrangement. I'm going to play a demo version of the song Killing an Arab. The studio version would eventually come up on your first official record, Three Imaginary Boys, but this is the demo version of Killing an Arab.
I was standing on the beach with a gun in my hand, staring at the sea, staring down the barrel at the Arab on the ground. She is up on my butt, I hear no sound, I'm alive. I dare, I'm a stranger, killing an Arab. I can turn him up away or I can fire the gun. I'm alive, I'm dead, I'm a stranger, killing an Arab.
So there's a few things going on there I'd like to ask you about. Obviously the words killing an Arab, I'll get to that in a little bit, but also, that was only recorded a year after that sort of straight-ahead punk that we heard from Easy Cure. So,
I think the question is really, why not? For us, with The Cure, we were never chained to one particular fashion or style, you know, not our whole career. So it's more a question of why we wouldn't change, why we wouldn't do different things. We never sort of thought, oh, we have to be this type of band or that type of band. We just went ahead and played what interested us every time.
It's also, like, less heavy. It's less driving. Do you think that, like, bringing it down, toning it down, letting Robert be a little softer in his singing, did that speak to your guys' personality and what you were trying to accomplish with the music?
Well, yeah, obviously. I mean, you know, a lot of bands, when they first start, the first thing they do is pick, you know, somebody that they like, an artist that they like, and try and write songs in that style. For us, it was a rather different process. We would go, okay, what don't we like? And we're gonna leave all those things out. And what we were left with was what we used. I mean, it's obvious to me in the track you played earlier that we are playing more sort of a, you know, it's punky, but it's more sort of straight ahead rock. And we wanted to leave some of those elements out because we didn't really find that they suited how we felt. Because one of the things I think The Cure was responsible for is giving people permission, especially young men, to be a little bit more sensitive, you know, and be able to express that emotional side of them without just being, you know, misogynistic or whatever, you know.
So getting to the lyrics, Killing an Arab, they were controversial at the time, they're controversial now. Can you explain where that came from?
Well, it has absolutely nothing to do with killing anybody or any kind of racist idea. It comes from a book called L'Étranger, The Stranger by Albert Camus, French existentialist writer. And in the book, you know, the main hero, the protagonist of the book, ends up murdering somebody for reasons he doesn't really understand and he can't really explain. And to us at the time, when especially like when Robert read it and I read it, we would like, okay, that kind of reflects our outsider value, the way that we felt about ourselves. So it seemed natural to write a song about that. It's unfortunate that various elements, you know, of society have taken it in the wrong way completely. And The Cure are on tour right now worldwide, and they're not playing the song at the moment for that reason, I would imagine.
Mm-hmm. After Imaginary Boys, you guys kept changing your style, and did you all get to contribute to the stylistic change, or was it led by Robert, or was it led by you?
The changes in the early days were led by all of us, really, because we were all together all of the time.
I mean, this sounds like it was a democracy of a band.
Yeah, I mean, you know, in the same way as any family or gang or friendship is a democracy, it's a democracy. I mean, you know, things change, they go up and down, and I think, you know, at some point you have a democracy, but at some point, you know, you have to have a leader of your democracy, because if you don't, you end up going around in circles a bit sometimes. So, you know, at one point we elected Robert as the leader, since he's the singer as well. And, you know, if he's got to sing certain things, well, then you've got to feel comfortable singing them. So, therefore, you know, he would have the final say on a lot of stuff like that. But, you know, it did all come from all of us as well.
You guys made three records following Three Imaginary Boys that sort of encapsulates the, shall I say, goth era of your guys' career. Does that...
Well, you could, you're welcome to say the era, but I don't think it's completely descriptive. To me, everything that we always did with The Cure was we wanted to avoid being fashionable more than anything else. That was our mantra, you know. We don't want to do something that's fashionable. So as soon as you start to stick a label on The Cure, we would go sideways to that. And I always felt goth was a little, you know, mono-focused, and which doesn't mean that it's bad at all, because there's lots of goth things that I've liked. But I never really felt that we were, you know, that was the only label that you could hang around us.
I tend to agree. I mean, even when I was very young, I would always hear Cure in conjunction with goth, but then I would hear the songs on the radio, and they sounded like pop, upbeat songs to me. I want to play one called Let's Go to Bed, and you're on keyboards on this one.
Right. I remember having a conversation with Robert, particularly about that single, and he was saying, well, most pop songs are, you know, songs that are in charts at the moment, they seem to be basically what they're trying to say is, you know, I want to go to bed with you. and you know, but they never get to the point. They sort of, you know, make it, you know, obscure it a little bit. And he thought, well, why don't I just have a song where I just say it, but I don't say it right to the very, very end, you know? And so that's where that came from, the whole idea.
It's quite contrary to a lot of the songs on the radio these days.
Yeah.
Also, this move to the synthesizer, what is it about the synthesizer that so intrigued you guys?
Well, you know, you can make any sound you like. And it's like when people make vegetarian food or vegan food, and they want to make sort of imitations of other dishes, like they want to make, you know, vegan spaghetti and meatballs. Well, I've always been the sort of person that was interested in making, you know, something different with vegetables, and we were interested in making something different with sounds. So to use a synthesizer wasn't to make it sound like a trumpet or whatever, even though we did from time to time. It was to make, you know, to make something interesting out of it that you may not have heard before. And that was always what drew me especially to synthesis, you know?
So your last album with the band was Disintegration. I'm going to play a song called Pictures of You.
Quietly open my eyes, but I never see
Again, that's Pictures of You from The Cure's 1989 album, Disintegration. The Disintegration sessions were a particularly hard time for you. You began to struggle more with your alcoholism, and the band was, they had problems with this.
Yeah, I mean, you know, alcoholism is a problem, as a disease, you know, something that has affected a lot of people in our society, which is one reason for writing the book. I wanted to be, you know, see if I could be of service to anybody and help anybody that found themselves in the same position. At a time of disintegration, it's fair to say that I was disintegrating. You know, a lot of my time in the studio wasn't actually spent in the studio. It was spent in a little room sitting outside the studio, and a little space inside my head trying to figure out how I could walk the 4 or 5 feet into the main studio and start working. Because what happens with the disease of alcoholism and addiction is it stops you and makes your world much, much smaller. That's where I was at the time, and it wasn't easy for anybody else around me. It wasn't easy for anybody in the band, especially, you know, because you have to consider that everybody in The Cure had been my friend for a very long time. So it's not easy to watch, your friend disintegrate, and that's what was happening for me.
You got cut loose by Robert. It wasn't easy for him. It certainly wasn't easy for you.
Right.
So you formed bands after being cut loose from The Cure. You used the names Presence and Livenhurst. But what was going on in your personal life throughout that time?
Well, you know, there were several things that happened. One was, you know, like people always talk about when they recover from alcoholism, because you can recover from it, which is the good news. You know, you have to reach the bottom. You have to reach the worst part of your life. And what happened to me was the worst part of my life actually happened about 3, 4, 5 years after I left The Cure. And I decided that I should take this big court case out and take everybody that I'd worked with to court, because, you know, I guess what I really wanted at the back of my heart was some kind of recompense, some kind of revenge. And it was really the worst decision of my life, because all it did was alienate people more and alienate myself. Out of that, I really found the solution that I was seeking. And I found a way out of my alcoholic problems and became whole again and recovered. And after that, everything that had gone wrong started to correct itself, and culminated really in the end with Robert and I and everybody else in The Cure getting back together again to play some shows in 2011.
Thank you, Lowell Tolhurst, for joining us on Radio Times today.
You're most welcome.
And we close out John Aaron's interview with The Cure co-founder Lowell Tolhurst with their 1989 hit song, Love Song. Tolhurst's new memoir is called Cured. Kevin Griffin, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times. Radio Times producers Debbie Bilder, John Aaron's, Elizabeth Fiedler, and Trinae Nuri. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen.